Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Appreciate you joining us this evening. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great for you to carve out some time to spend with us this evening. Brad Omlin produces the show. So I want to delve a little bit deeper. You know, I finally got the opportunity after a couple of days ago posting a admittedly controversial op-ed from the Washington Post entitled The Libertarian Case for Open Borders. I posted this to my Facebook account and I asked people, I put out a plea, you know, a sincere plea. And I said, look, I'm not looking to have an argument. I'm not looking to, you know, get into the typical social media comment thread, you know, personal attacks, all that nonsense. I don't got time for that. But what I am interested in is trying to understand people's responses to this op-ed. I'm trying to you know, look, I've got an agenda, obviously, right? Like, I have a set of opinions, a worldview that I'm trying to promote. But to that end, I also want to understand where people are at and how people react to this case that's laid out in the Washington Post regarding open borders, which of course is, you know, something that most listeners to this program, the overwhelming majority of listeners to this program, recoil in horror at the very notion of open borders. And let me give you this. Let me give you this much. With good cause, right? And this is something that I recognized particularly over the past 24 hours. I realized what my error has been because we've been talking about this for a while. We've been talking about this, you know, since the news has been centered around the controversy involving the separation of children at the border that Donald Trump just addressed with his executive order, and of course is going to remain in the news and probably going to end up to one degree or another being an issue all the way up until the midterm elections this November. That has been a catalyst for us to talk frequently and in depth about the issue of immigration, and I've been trying to challenge the status quo on this within conservative thought. I've been putting forward ideas that I know rub you the wrong way. And my effort there is not to, you know, it's not to be provocative. You know, this isn't something, look, here's something I recognize. I recognize that there is a point past which you are not going to want to hear it anymore, right? And so I'm not trying to get you to that point where you don't want to hear it. What I'm trying to get you to is a point where you actually think, huh, there's something to that. There's something worth considering there. You know, not that you're necessarily going to change your opinion, and that's not the objective necessarily, but that you'll reconsider some of the premises that have been motivating or informing your thinking up to this point. And that's what I really want to focus on tonight is the contextual premises which are informing everybody's opinion on the issue of immigration. The revelation or the realization that I've had over the past 24 hours is that, you know, based upon the calls we've gotten into this program, based upon the response that I've gotten on social media, it's very clear to me that people are not hearing what it is that I'm saying. And that is something that is 100% my fault. I'm the professional communicator in this relationship, right? So if you're not picking up on what I'm putting down, it's because I'm not putting it down in the right way. And so let's reset, shall we? Let's reset on this issue of immigration and back up a few notches and approach from a different angle and see if maybe we can connect. Maybe we can. And again, not that you're going to agree with me. That's not the objective. The objective is to understand. That's what I'm trying to get you, the listener, to meet me on, is a understanding of what it is that I'm saying, just like I'm trying to understand what you guys are saying back to me so that we can then have a conversation moving forward about what the future should look like. So here's the revelation. We tend to think of immigration as a matter of policy. And as a matter of policy, it redounds to a set of rules that we adopt. And so when we think about those rules, we think about what those rules ought to be. We aren't thinking critically about the broader context in which those rules are being developed. And so, you know, what I mean is that when you start to talk about immigration law or immigration policies, you evade unintentionally addressing the broader context in which those laws are being crafted. And specifically what I'm talking about here is the status quo of our other laws, the status quo of our culture, the fact that right now, currently in the United States of America, we do not have a fully rights-respecting culture and a fully rights-respecting government, not by a long shot, right? I mean, this was the thrust, this was the core of what drove the Tea Party, you know, starting in 2008, was the recognition that we have drifted far afield from the constitutional foundations of the country. And, you know, the principles that were chosen as those that were the pillars of the Tea Party movement were constitutionally limited government. Limited why? Limited for the purpose of preserving the ability of individuals to guide their own lives and to take full ownership of their own lives. Fiscal responsibility, right? You shouldn't spend more than you take in. You know, little things like that. You ought to have sustainable programs and what have you. And free markets. Again, appealing to the right of individuals to make choices about their lives. And so when I make my case for immigration, I'm making it from the perspective of a context that is different from what it is today. In other words, I'm looking at what the world ought to look like, the full context of it, not necessarily the way things are right now today. So a lot of the pushback and a lot of the concern and feedback that I've received as we've talked about immigration in the past few days has been coming from the presumption that nothing else, that if we change immigration law, that nothing else is going to change along with it. And that's not what I'm advocating for, right? I'm not saying, oh, let's just open the borders and then change nothing else about the way we conduct business in the United States of America. And certainly I understand I'm trying to think of the right word to pick here to describe it. You know, the pushback, we'll say that. I certainly understand the pushback if you're hearing, let's have open borders and then change nothing else about the way things are done in the United States. That would be bad. That would be the wrong move for a vast variety of reasons. But that's not what I'm advocating for. What I'm advocating for is a society that is structured around the principle of individual rights. What I'm advocating for is a libertarian society, one where the focus and locus of our law is to preserve the right of individuals to take full ownership of their lives and to pursue their own values in order to affect their own happiness. And in that context, the question of what should immigration policy be takes on a whole new, unprecedented flavor. And that's the basis. As we continue here tonight, going through the various objections, this is the missing context that I neglected to provide, which to my mind, you know, hopefully will provide a deeper sense of understanding about where it is that I'm coming from, which is one of my goals here on the program. So let's start ticking through the various categories of feedback. And I'm going to cite here, you know, I had a number of very thoughtful and generous friends who contributed to the comment thread on Facebook under this Washington Post op-ed, The Libertarian Case for Open Borders. And we're going to go ahead and cite a number of the comments that were left as examples of these different categories of response and objection to that op-ed. So the first area that I want to discuss is the difficulty of absorbing waves of immigrants. Frank writes, "So you open the borders and millions pour in. 25,000 decide that Albertville, which is the city in which I reside, is where they want to be. So how do you absorb that influx of people? You can't depend on state or federal help. Everyone is overwhelmed. It sounds nice if you suspend reality and logic. And so that's Frank's comment. Now, he's correct under the presumption, under the premise that, you know, a plane comes along or a caravan comes along and just unloads 25,000 people into your city and then leaves, right? Like that's, in that scenario, yes, you are in trouble. But that's, again, that is not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a scenario where we just start shipping immigrants in or allowing immigrants to be shipped in and there's no other contextual change or we have the status quo in terms of programs and entitlements and what have you. I'm talking about what ought to exist under the condition of liberty. And under the condition of liberty, there exists no obligation to absorb anyone. And the reason for that is that under the condition of liberty, out of necessity, each individual person is responsible for themselves and accountable for their actions. If you need something, if there's a value that you require or that you want, something that you seek to obtain and keep, you have to act in order to obtain it. That's called productivity. You have to work in order to obtain that which you need. And that applies under a condition of liberty. That applies to every single individual, whether they're an immigrant, whether they're native born, whether they can't come from the next state over, the next town over. It doesn't matter. Your background becomes irrelevant under a condition of liberty. And there is no obligation to absorb anyone whatsoever. And we talked a little bit about this last night, this idea of, you know, the hypothetical of my city, my town, trying to absorb 25,000 people, which is, you know, more than three times the amount of the current population. There is no scenario where that would happen, right? Like, there isn't the capacity, there isn't the housing, it doesn't exist, and nobody's going to build it, right? And you have the context of, you know, planning and zoning laws, you know, there are a number of checks upon that. And even if you had reforms that were market-based, where planning and zoning either went away or was scaled down significantly and people could actually do what they wanted with their own property, you would be hard-pressed to find people who were interested in trying to accommodate an influx of 25,000 people who have nothing to offer in trade. Now, that's not going to happen. Now, conversely, when you do have people show up who have something of value to offer, you know, whether it be their labor or whatever wealth they're bringing with them or whatever the case may be, then in that case, they're going to be welcome. They're going to be welcome the same as any traveler would be. And we see this all the time. Every single municipality out there has something analogous to a chamber of commerce, if not a chamber of commerce. And the whole point of the chamber of commerce is to get together and try to develop the economy and the business opportunities of that area. And what do? You solicit tourism, right? You want people to come. Why? Why would we got, you know, Frank brings up Albertville. What's Albertville's current claim to fame? The reason it's on the map right now. It's the outlet mall, right? The big outlet mall out there on 94 as you drive west towards St. Cloud. It's right there in Albertville. Now, you know what the number one source of consumers to that mall is? Travelers from Canada, which is amazing to me. Like, I don't understand why people are traveling from Canada to go there, but whatever. They see the value in it, and we welcome them, right? Why? Because they got money. They got dollars to spend, and we are eager to take them in trade for stuff that those Canadians think is more valuable. Everybody walks away better off. And it's something that's encouraged, right? So this idea that we need to keep people away in order to prevent us from suffering some sort of economic harm, it doesn't play out under a condition of liberty. And so, again, the locus should be not to, you know, change immigration policy and not change anything else, but to affect the condition of liberty so that these perceived economic threats from immigration no longer exist. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Otson. So, you know, the news has been all about immigration, the separation of children from their parents at the border, and that has been a catalyst for us to have an introspective conversation about immigration policy over the past few days. And it's a conversation that has caused some contention. And some, you know, frankly, amongst some sectors, anger regarding the position, the direction that Brad and I here on the program have been coming at it from. Because we're looking at this from a libertarian perspective. We're looking at this from the premise that individuals everywhere, by the way, not just people who happen to be American-born citizens, but individuals by virtue of the fact that they are human beings, are in full ownership of their lives and ought to be able to control what relationships they enter into and on what terms, both foreigner and domestic citizen. And indeed, but by virtue of the fact that you have this black market commerce that takes place whereby illegal immigrants are hired in order to do, you know, various jobs, it demonstrates, if nothing else, that there does exist a market demand for the labor that they have to offer. And so the premise here is that two people who want to, it's just like that when we talk in domestically about the minimum wage. If two people want to enter into an economic transaction, who are we to say they can't? Who is the government to step in and say, no, we don't agree with the terms that you two have set for each other? It's none of your business, right? And the same applies to the concept of immigration. Now, this is something that rubs a lot of people, perhaps even you, the wrong way. And I understand why. It occurred to me over the past 24 hours as I've been thinking about it, that when we talk about immigration policy, the focus is on the setting the rules, right? You know, what rules should be in place. And when we're focused on the rules, we are not talking about or not focused on the context in which those rules are being set. And that's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the broader context. I want to have a society where all of the things that contribute to what are perceived as immigration problems actually have nothing to do with immigration policy whatsoever. They have to do with our broader public policy. They have to do with the welfare state. They have to do with the extent to which the government is involved in interfering with the economy. They have to do with the fact that although we are the freest nation on earth and we have this wonderful legacy of human liberty to look back upon with pride as a country, we nonetheless are far from the ideal scenario wherein individuals are truly in full ownership of their lives. And that's the direction that we ought to be aiming towards. And so I've been referencing a number of concerns, comments that were left in a comment thread on Facebook on this topic, and break down into a variety of different categories of concern. And one of the concerns that's very frequently brought up is security. Alan writes, do you have a lock on your front door? That's the rhetorical question. Now, this is something that a number of callers into the program, this is a metaphor that has been raised a number of times. The idea that you properly ought to be able to control your property. You control who comes into your home. You vet who comes into your home. You don't just throw the door open and, you know, have an open door policy for, you know, anybody off the street who wants to come in. It's your property. You get to control it. And it's true. I do. And I do have a lock on my front door. It keeps people out of my house. And my control over my house will remain intact regardless of immigration policy, right? You know, If tomorrow we just declared open borders and anybody who wanted to could come into the United States of America, that doesn't mean they get to come into my house, right? my property is still my property. My relationships, my chosen interactions are still my chosen interactions. And, you know, particularly if we, when we focus, we pull back and we look on the context of broader policy, so many of these concerns that are raised when we talk about immigration are indicative of the fact that we don't have a full condition of liberty in this country, right? But certainly when we think about this particular example of your private property, you get to protect that regardless of whether it's from an immigrant or from your guy next door who was born in the next county over and has been an American his entire life. Either way, your private property remains intact. And the other way in which this metaphor is used is in a collectivist way to try to convey the sense that the land of the United States is somehow communal property that properly ought to be controlled through public policy. And that's a concept that I just fundamentally reject. The land of the United States does not belong to the United States. It is broken up into various pieces of private property that is owned by those property owners. And again, under the context of liberty, in a condition of liberty, maintaining private property rights would be sufficient to guard against this concern about security and whether or not you're going to have your property secure and what have you. Another area of concern that's often raised is the welfare state argument. This is very much related to the last one. Matt writes, nice theory. He's referencing the libertarian case for open borders written at the Washington Post. But the reality to support the unskilled immigrants, the government puts a gun to my head and takes more from me every other taxpayer, violating one of the basic tenets of libertarianism that one's rights end when they infringe on another's. Now, this is true, right? Obviously, your rights, what defines your rights is those same rights held by another person. You don't get to, you know, the way it's commonly phrased is your right to swing your fist ends at the other man's nose. And generally speaking, that's true. But when you go to this as well, it's the welfare state exists, therefore we can't have a loosening of immigration restrictions. That argument stands as an indictment of the welfare state, not of the immigrants. And again, what I'm pointing us towards here is a broad reform, not just immigration reform. You know, that's the problem here, is our focus is just on the immigration. No, it needs to be much broader than that. We need to reform everything. We need to drain the swamp and have broad-based revolutionary reform of all public policy towards the end of securing the rights of individuals to claim full ownership over their lives and control the relationships they enter into. And in that circumstance, you're not going to have to worry about a welfare state because it's not going to exist. That should be the goal. And again, I would take this argument much more seriously if I believed that people were passionate about ending the welfare state and then loosening immigration restrictions. But I have a tough time buying that that's actually what people want. It occurs to me that the real concern here is maintaining entitlements for oneself rather than ending the entitlement state and the welfare state. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Going down a list of concerns and objections that are raised when we challenge the status quo on conservative opinion when it comes to the issue of immigration. And part of the problem, you know, this is the revelation that I've had over the past 24 hours of thinking about it, is that that's how we frame it, as the immigration issue, immigration policy. You know, just conceptually, in terms of the language and how we talk about it, when we think of it in those terms as the immigration policy, right, then that carves out the rules, the set of rules that apply to immigration, and focuses our consideration on those rules at the exclusion of literally everything else. And what I'm trying to get after and have been trying to get after for, you know, the past couple of days that we've been talking about immigration in light of the controversy with separation of children at the borders and what have you, I realize that the way we've been talking about it here on the program has failed to zoom out from immigration to look at the broader context of our society overall, of all our public policy, and the fact that we need to change much more than just the rules that apply to who can come here and on what terms. We need to have broad-based, revolutionary reform of our entire American jurisprudence in order to affect the condition of liberty, wherein people are able to direct their own affairs, choose which relationships they're going to enter into, and on what terms. So, you know, a scenario where your private property is wholly protected. You know, it's yours. You do not have to worry about somebody encroaching upon it, somebody taxing you in order to pay for somebody else's benefits, you know, you having to yield control over your life or that which you've earned to somebody else, you know, whether they're an immigrant or not. It shouldn't matter whether the person who's encroaching upon your rights comes from Mexico or comes from Wisconsin. Either way, it's an infringement that should not be endured and should not be tolerated. So let's continue with our conversation here. And this, again, is based on comments and responses that I've gotten on social media. One of the concerns that's raised when we talk about immigration is cultural assimilation. Joshua writes, "What makes America America is the fact that we respect each other's rights to disagree. Allowing open borders of people who don't understand that premise interferes with the people who love this land and practice that we can agree to disagree without violence. Assimilation must be part of the immigration process, or the society you live in will devolve into one that looks nothing like this with no liberty. Respect and freedom and our Constitution. When you come to this nation, you leave yours behind. The culture, the practice come with you, but you are leaving your nation to be part of this one, not to change it." That, again, from Joshua commenting on social media. And, you know, this respect that Joshua speaks of, you know, he's right. We do in the United States of America. What makes America America is indeed our respect of each other's rights, particularly the right to disagree. This is real tolerance, right? The left is so fond of misusing this term tolerance when, in fact, they're the most intolerant among us. But the true meaning of tolerance is exactly that. You can hold a different view than I do, and we can walk away with goodwill and mutual respect and not kill each other over it, right? The respect that Joshua cites here necessitates tolerance of ideas with which we disagree. Indeed, large swaths of the native-born population of this country maintain beliefs and entire belief systems which reject the concept of individual rights. So when Joshua talks about, you know, the fact that there are, you know, hypothetically, there are immigrants who are coming here who don't believe in the same libertarian, tolerant views that we do, that don't have respect for the freedoms of speech and the freedoms of religious expression and what have you, I understand that concern, but I'm as concerned, and shouldn't we all be as concerned about the native-born people who reject those concepts, the people who live right next door to us, who think that they ought to be able to restrict our liberty, restrict our speech, restrict our religious expression? I would think that that's kind of important. Now, should we deport them? Should we arrest people who are progressives? Should we arrest people who are Democrats? Should we arrest people and ship them off to another country because they believe that our rights should not be respected and should not exist? Now, or should we build a wall around them, right? Should we build a giant wall around Minneapolis and St. Paul and keep all of the urban people in there so that the rest of us can live in a relative libertarian utopia? Now, I don't float these ideas entirely in jest. I'm asking seriously because if indeed the premise is correct, that the ideas which people hold stand as a threat which justifies the use of force, which is basically what people are arguing for in the case of immigration. You know, people think the wrong thoughts, they have the wrong culture, therefore we should use force to keep them out. If that premise is correct, then the answer to whether or not we should round people up for thinking the wrong things domestically or build walls around entire cities where the people are lefties and want to take our rights away, the answer to those questions is yes, we should be doing that. And obviously, you know, this runs against, rightfully, runs against our instincts when we put it in those terms. What other example can you point to where being born in this country gives you the right to violate your neighbor, right? There isn't. And so this distinction between domestic and foreign, native-born and immigrant, doesn't actually matter in the moral context of whether or not you get to have thoughts that don't jive with libertarianism or conservatism. Freedom of speech applies to everyone. Freedom of expression applies to everyone. Freedom of conscience applies to everyone. And it is never okay to respond with force to somebody else's thoughts. And we recognize that. We recognize, as conservatives, the unconstitutional and immoral nature of the suggestion that we ought to round people up domestically or build walls around people domestically because they think the wrong things. We recognize that we may not justly punish someone for the content of their speech. And that's why we have the First Amendment. And so this cultural concern, to my mind, it's misinformed on those grounds, the grounds that another person's culture is never a justification for initiating force against them, number one. But number two, I have faith that our culture will endure. You know why? You know why I'm not concerned about, you know, the Muslims coming here and spreading Sharia law and driving us into the dark age and what have you? The reason why I'm not concerned about that is because our culture has endured in the midst of darkness. Our culture has prevailed in the face of evil, and it has done so for centuries. It has done so against the odds and against the prognostications of people throughout the world and against the effort of people throughout the world. Some of the most vile villains in the history of the human species have failed as they've crashed against the rock of American liberty. Our culture will endure because it proves inherently superior. And that's why people want to come here. It's why people want to come here. They come here because we are that shining city on the hill. They come here because we offer that unprecedented opportunity to be something more, to do something better, to build something for yourself. And the idea that that's suddenly going to collapse or that that light's going to be snuffed out because we allow people to come here, that's an expression of, that's a vote of no confidence in the American dream. And I don't share that fear. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Once again, we find ourselves talking about immigration this evening. And, you know, hopefully, if you've been listening throughout the program so far, you recognize that this really goes well beyond immigration. And that's the piece that I've been missing. You know, this is a negligence on my part, an oversight on my part in terms of how I've been framing this conversation over the past few days as we've been reacting to the controversy over the separation of children at the border as migrant families are crossing illegally. You know, we've been focused on what should the rules be, what should the policy be at the border. And when we put our focus there, we neglect taking a look at the broader context in which that decision is being made. And the real problems, this is the revelation I've had over the past day, the real problems are not in immigration policy. The real problems are in all of the rest of public policy. It's everywhere else. It's the welfare state. It's entitlements. It's the extent to which the government is interfering in the economy. It's the disparity between the human liberty, which we have the moral right to and properly ought to have, and the status quo of our laws, federal, state, and local. And so the reform that needs to take place here, people talk about immigration reform. That's not a broad enough term. The reform that needs to take place here goes well beyond immigration to our entire broader society. And so I'm trying to demonstrate that here by responding to a number of comments that have been made on social media by folks who I respect for having contributed to this effort. One of them is friend of the show, Jake Duesenberg, the president of Action for Liberty. He spoke to the need to protect ourselves from criminals. He wrote, it's ignoring the underlying problem. And he's referring to the op-ed in the Washington Post entitled The Libertarian Case for Open Borders. He says, protecting our borders from nefarious actors is a worthwhile concern. We clearly do not want people coming into our country to do harm and add to our crime rates. Open borders would essentially leave an opening for those actors to come in. Instead, there should be a very open policy to let people into this country to work as long as they come through some sort of vetting process to ensure safety. Now, I understand the sentiment here, but again, this concept is not something that we would apply in virtually any other situation. For example, we don't stop people traveling across state borders or municipal borders to vet their character, in spite of the fact that crimes clearly occur on an interstate basis and clearly occur from one city to the other. You know, and indeed, statistics show that crime rates among illegal immigrant populations are actually lower than those in the general population, a fact which undermines this concern dramatically. And this style of reasoning, if it was applied in other areas of policy, would raise all kinds of red flags for conservatives. You know, one of the primary justifications cited for abortion by the pro-choice movement is the probability that unwanted children may someday become criminals or otherwise become a burden on society. So should we therefore kill babies in the womb in order to prevent them from becoming criminals one day? You know, one of the primary justifications for Jim Crow was the purported probability of blacks committing crimes in white neighborhoods. And, you know, that's a specter that's still cited today, even though it's heavily veiled through local planning and zoning mechanisms. And we recognize that such reasoning is conceptually flawed and deeply immoral. You do not get to presume someone is a criminal on account of their demographics. The answer to crime is affecting justice on a case-by-case basis, acting upon evidence of individual lawbreaking, not treating an entire group of people as suspect by virtue of their mere existence. And that's what this notion of we've got to keep out the immigrants in order to protect ourselves from crime, that's what it does. That's what it says, is that you are a suspect by virtue of the fact that you come from somewhere else. And this is not logical. It's not rational. It's not moral. It's not something we should be embracing. And it's not something we do embrace when it's implied in other areas of public policy. And, you know, another thing I'll shoehorn in here at the end of the hour is when I talk about broader reform, we also need criminal justice reform, and not in the sense that, you know, immediately comes to mind necessarily when you hear that term. We need to be more lenient in some areas and much more severe in others. You know, a lot of the crime that's cited in this conversation about immigration, things like rape, things like murder, MS-13, you know, the violence that takes place, those types of crimes should be punished with the death penalty. People should be being put to death when they turn to murder, when they become murderers, when they become rapists. Not having a proper justice system generally is part of the problem that contributes to these immigration concerns, these crime concerns related to immigration. So again, it's not just about what the law is at the border, what the rule is at the border. It's about our broader context of public policy and whether or not things need to change profoundly there as well. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right. We got a little bit more here to talk about regarding immigration and the broader implications for all of public policy, which is really where I think our focus ought to be. It's not so much what the rules at the border are or ought to be, so much as what our broader public policy ought to be. What's wrong with our overall approach to government that seems to necessitate, in the minds of so many, these restrictions at the border? That's the question that we've been addressing here tonight on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Brad Omlin produces the show. We're going to get into some of the other news this evening, you know, immigration-related and otherwise, and we're also going to talk with Kelly Gunderson from Americans for Prosperity later this hour regarding her firsthand impressions of the town hall, the roundtable that was held by President Donald Trump during his recent visit to Duluth this week. So look forward to that as we move along with the program tonight. So, you know, there's one last area that is raised that I've cited here that was raised in a comment thread on social media regarding immigration and in response to an op-ed that was written at the Washington Post entitled "The Libertarian Case for Open Borders." And we've been going through, you know, various categories of reaction that I've received both from callers and from commenters on this thread, many of whom are friends of mine who I know and respect. One of those being Jake Duesenberg, the president of Action for Liberty. And he addressed this concern that's frequently raised, which is the electoral consequences of lifting immigration restrictions. So this is what Jake had to say. Mass immigration becomes a large problem when voting rights are granted and there is an enormous welfare state. Now, I think that's a pretty fair characterization of the fears held by a lot of people, and not without cause, right? You know, certainly the founding fathers, I can't off the top of my head immediately cite who and when they said it, but they said something to the effect of, when you grant people the ability, when people become aware of the fact that they can vote themselves benefits, they can vote themselves largesse from the federal treasury, you're on the path to undermining your republic, something to that effect. That when people realize that through the power of the polling place, they can actually vote to give themselves stuff, you're going to be in trouble. Unless you have some principled morality that restrains that temptation and that people actually govern themselves. And so this concern that that could happen, that if we let in a bunch of immigrants, that they're going to vote as and for Democrats, is something that's understandable on its face. But how do we address this? Well, first of all, I think we have to set aside the question of whether immigration necessitates citizenship or voting rights, which is not at all certain and a completely separate issue. You know, the choice to let people come across the border is not the same thing as granting them citizenship. It's not the same thing as granting them voting rights. And so it's a potentially disingenuous to conflate these things as if they're one and the same. They're not. Being able to come here is not the same thing as being able to vote. It's not the same thing as becoming a U.S. citizen. So we should set that consideration aside. That said, when we get to the question of whether or not a person should be able to vote, their ability to do so should never be contingent upon how we think they will vote. And I'm going to say that again because I think it's extraordinarily important, and I think it's something that has been neglected and overlooked to the shame of a lot of my conservative brethren and a lot of my Republican brethren. A person's ability to vote should never, ever be contingent upon how we think they will vote. And frankly, that is a morally reprehensible motivation. The idea that, you know, a person's ability to vote should be restricted because we don't think they're going to vote the right way. I mean, just think about it, right? You know, the idea that, well, we don't think you should vote because we don't think you're going to vote correctly. That's you imposing your politics upon that other person. The question of whether or not a person should be able to vote should be left to qualifications. The question is, what should qualify a person to be able to vote? That's the consideration. And then what a person decides to do with their franchise, with their ability to cast a ballot, once they qualify, is entirely their business and should not come into our consideration of what the law ought to be governing who qualifies. And Republicans need to stop thinking along these lines. And it's not just for moral reasons. Like, for me, the big consideration here is the moral argument of it's immoral to say, I don't want Democrats to vote. You know, it's immoral to say, I want to erect barriers to keep people from voting for Democrats. That's a immoral position, regardless of the fact that, and, you know, I can hear through the speakers of your radio, you shouting at me about how horrible the Democrats are and about how we need to defeat the Democrats. And I agree with you. I agree with you. Of course we do. And their positions are morally reprehensible. Their worldview is morally reprehensible. And we should do everything we can to fight their worldview. But by fight, I mean persuade. By fight, I mean convince individuals that what we have to offer is better, which it is. You know, that, again, this is really kind of I'm going to be careful how I phrase this. It's a vote of no confidence. When you believe that the only way you can win an election is by keeping people from voting, that's a vote of no confidence in the merit of your ideas. What you're saying is, we don't actually have a product that's worth supporting. We don't actually have ideas that people will want to get behind. And when you concede that point, well, then of course you're going to lose, right? Of course people are going to want to vote for the other party when you've already made the decision for them that you can't persuade them to come over to your side. This is something that Republicans need to step away from. And I say this as somebody who was deeply involved during the height of the Tea Party in efforts at securing election integrity. I remain 100% in favor of photo voter ID. You ought to be able to present an ID at the ballot box in order to secure your ballot so that we know you are who you say you are. That's common sense. It's basic security. It should happen. What I'm suggesting is, though, is that a lot of the rhetoric that was employed to that end, and a lot of the rhetoric that you hear employed whenever there's a conversation about restoring the franchise to people who are felons and have been released back into society, all of it is based upon, or much of it is based upon, this idea of how they're going to vote. And what I would suggest to you is that the best way around that is to actually offer them something that they want to vote for. In the long term, it occurs to me that just as a practical reality, in the long term, that's what you're going to have to do. Because if your long-term strategy is based upon keeping people from the polls, that's a battle you are eventually going to lose. Right? Like, if the only thing you have to offer is the case for why people shouldn't be allowed to vote at all, then when they do get the opportunity, they're not going to vote for you, right? So there need to be reasons why people who immigrate here should vote for Republicans. There need to be reasons why people who have a criminal record should vote for Republicans. And we can provide those from a conservative, ideologically consistent worldview that is not caving, it's not compromising, it's not yielding on our fundamental beliefs. It's consistent with our fundamental beliefs. We can come up with that. And it's rested upon, it's rooted in this concept of individual rights. You know, the shining city on a hill concept, the make America great again concept, is one of profound optimism, profound belief in the human potential, in the ability of individuals to go forth and conquer their environment and to turn it around productively into something that works for them and to engage in productive, economically fruitful, mutually beneficial relationships. And that is something that can and should and will appeal to people, whether they are from here or they are from somewhere else, whether they made mistakes in their past by, you know, committing crimes, or whether they've got a clean record going back to the day they were born. You know, that's something that we can get people to vote for, and that should be our focus rather than keeping them from the borders. I want to hit a clip here. We might have to, we got two clips, and we'll hit the one here from Hillary Clinton because it's shorter and we got a break coming up. This is an interesting contrast between what we've heard her saying recently. You know, in the space where we've been reacting to children being separated from their families after illegal border crossings, we've had Hillary Clinton coming out talking about how reprehensible it is, how terrible it is, how Donald Trump's a horrible person, how all of his supporters are horrible people, and what have you. Well, in 2014, four whole years ago, she had a different take on the issue. Let's take a listen to that.
We have to send a clear message. Just because your child gets across the border, that doesn't mean the child gets to stay.
Should they be sent back?
Well, first of all, we have to provide the best emergency care we can provide. We have children 5 and 6 years old who have come up from Central America. We need to do more to provide border security in southern Mexico.
They should be sent back now.
Well, they should be sent back as soon as it can be determined who responsible adults and their families are, because there are concerns about whether all of them can be sent back. But I think all of them who can be should be reunited with their families.
So there you go. Hillary Clinton, a mere 4 years ago, taking a very different rhetorical stance on the question of immigration, the question of families who cross the border illegally, talking about how the kids need to be sent back. Now, you know, imagine how would she be portrayed by her own people today if she was saying exactly the same thing? We all know the answer to that question. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I got another clip here that I want to play for you. This one comes from a social media production called The Wall, which I found on Facebook. I'm sure you can find it easily enough by doing a search for it. And it has to do with immigration. You know, they talk to a number of ranchers who live on the border. And I was very intrigued by what they had to say, a lot of the old timers, what they had to say about the history of what has taken place along their border ranches. Let's take a listen.
Backtracking to time, say, 30 years ago, there was a steady flow of illegals coming through a ranch, and they usually would ask if we could give them a couple of days' work.
Ahí, apártalo.
Whether or not they were going to go further north or not, but they'd come over and work for you. And there was nothing extraordinary about it. It wasn't a big deal to go across the line. It wasn't a big deal for them to come over here. And then in the 80s, it started changing. It was 300 a month, and every one of them wanted a drink of water and directions.
And we always did. We kept a can of Spam and bread.
And then in the 90s, it was 300 a day. And they just stole stuff and broke stuff, and trucks stolen, cars stolen, saddles. Had two horses stolen. Got one back. But what's happened since the mid-2000s is the cartels took over the human trade as well as the drug trade. That's what the whole border's about now, just money. It, you know, it isn't about immigration. It's about smuggling.
And that right there, from the horse's mouth, from the rancher's mouth, is the point that I've been trying to make throughout this entire program and through the past few days here on immigration, is that it's really not, this is the the counterintuitive revelation here. Immigration as an issue is not actually about immigration. It's not. Immigration policy is not about immigration. Immigration policy is about economics. Immigration policy is about politics. It's a reflection of where we are as a society relative to where we ought to be on the spectrum of liberty. You know, here's the bottom line. Here's the thesis statement that I have to cover all of this. If we lived in a world, if we crafted for ourselves a society wherein each individual human being was truly free, was truly in complete ownership of their own life, truly, meaningfully, practically had their right to life, their right to liberty, their right to property and the ability to pursue happiness protected, if they could trust on the criminal justice system to actually execute justice, to administrate justice, to make things right, to rebalance the scales. If we lived in that society, then the problems that are today associated with illegal immigration would cease to be problems. You wouldn't have to worry about, and it's revealed in that clip that I just played. And, you know, you go right past it and you don't even notice it. They talk about the history. They talk about the fact that it didn't used to be a problem. They've lived there. These guys have lived there for 30, 40 years. And back in the day, before the 70s, it wasn't a big deal. You know, people would come across the border and, you know, they'd ask for a job. They'd ask for a drink of water. And through free association and dealing with each other as civilized human beings, they were able to negotiate. It wasn't a problem. But then something happened. Do you notice that? Right in the 70s. And then it shifted again in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. It started to ratchet up. Things started to get worse. And it correlated with the rise of cartels. And what is it that cartels specialize in? What is it that the cartels do? How did they make their money? They make their money by engaging in the black market. The black market for drugs and the black market for immigration. In other words, they operate within this pocket of anarchy that we have created with our laws by establishing and expanding the war on drugs, by creating and ratcheting up immigration restrictions. We have created the black market opportunity for the cartels to come into existence and expand their influence. We have done that to ourselves, just like we did with prohibition of alcohol. The Al Capone, the gangs, the mob. You know, there's precedent for this in history. We are creating the problem by turning away from Lady Liberty. If we turn back to her loving embrace, if we turn once more to the wisdom of the founding generation, of our founding fathers, who, you know, they weren't big on immigration restrictions. Hate to break it to you, right? You didn't have a wall at the borders of the newly minted, newly born United States of America. That's not something that they were interested in or found any virtue in pursuing. It wasn't even on their radar. And it wasn't viewed as necessary because the amalgam, the effect of the law was such that a general condition of human liberty was enjoyed. And in that context, you can't be harmed by another person, whether they're your neighbor who was born the next county over, or they're a recent immigrant from another part of the world. What we need is justice. What we need is to uphold individual rights, to uphold property rights, to uphold the right to liberty and the right to property. We do that and we'll have nothing to fear from another human being whatsoever. We'll be able to protect ourselves. will be able to affect justice when criminals do arise. We'll be able to address these problems on a case-by-case basis. And we will be able to promote, like, the opposite of the fear is going to happen. The fear is, oh, we're going to lose the culture. You know, people are going to fail to assimilate. You know, we're going to end up descending into this anti-libertarian, anti-American diaspora of progressive, politically correct nonsense. No, the opposite is true. When you respect people's rights, when you provide them with refuge, when you demonstrate through their own life experience the value of freedom, they're going to lap that up. They're going to love it. And they're going to want to do everything they can to protect it and to embrace it and to facilitate it and to spread it to others through their influence. That's how we get to a position of peace. That's how we get to a position of justice. We have to start by respecting other people's rights. And in turn, they'll realize the value, the mutually assured benefit of respecting ours as well. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. We're going to be joined here by Kelly Gunderson. Kelly Gunderson works for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota, and she had the honor of attending the roundtable, which took place up in the Duluth area, where President Donald Trump came to town and spoke with a number of economic stakeholders. We have her on the line now.
Hey, Walter. Thanks for having me on. It's always good to talk with you.
It's good to have you. It's been a while. It's been too long. I just ended up spending some time recently with your associate, Jason Flores, and that was a good time. I realized, man, I haven't talked to these EFP people in a while.
Yeah, Americans for Prosperity is doing work all around the state. He was in Mankato while I was up in Duluth listening to the president. So it was it's a good time.
So talk a little bit about that encounter. You attended the roundtable that the president held with different stakeholders in the economy up there in the Iron Range. Who was there, and what was the venue like?
So the venue was, it looked to be like a warehouse. There was pallets and I think like rolls of paper that kind of were strategically placed to kind of create this more of an intimate setting where the president, majority leader Kevin McCarthy, Representative Jason Lewis, Representative Tom Emmer, and then some people from the area were kind of in a U-shaped table up on a stage, and then in front of them was I was a member of the audience of about 100 people. Mm-hmm. And it was just fascinating to be there, to be in that close of proximity to be to the president, no matter who the president
sure.
is. That's a thrilling event.
Right.
And so there was, I remember that there was a union president. There was president, I think, of the Iron Mining Association there. There were some other representatives of companies and employees all having a discussion of what's been going on in the area of northern Minnesota lately in terms of industry and economy.
So how was the flow of the conversation? You know, was this something that was relatively, you know, I'm sure there was some structure to it, but were there moments of candor, moments of, you know, that were kind of unpredictable in terms of the things that different people said, including the president? What kinds of things were being discussed?
Not too much in terms of unpredictability. I think everybody had a few notes that they wanted to say.
Right.
The president started off with, you know, introducing some people and having some words that he wanted to talk about on different subjects. He did mention immigration and the executive order that he had signed just before leaving Washington, D.C. to come to the Duluth.
Right.
Talked about border control and the order that he signed to keep families together of illegal immigrants crossing the border. So he had a few words on that. Then he went into what regulation and tax cuts have been doing in the United States, mm-hmm. and that currently the growth in GDP is about 3.2% for the year, mm-hmm. and that he expects it to hit to 4 before the end of 2018. And then he kind of went around the he did start off. See, I know he did this at the rally too. He did start off with how he was so happy to be in Minnesota to visit Duluth, and he had said, "We were so close of winning Minnesota in 2016, yeah. and just a little bit, he just said, you know, one more speech, and we would have had it."
Right, right, right.
Representative Jason Lewison later followed up with that he believes that that Minnesota will go red in 2020 for the president in his reelection campaign. So that was a fun, lighthearted moment.
It's a real possibility. I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but it's a combination of, on the one hand, the positivity, and this is something that, you know, as somebody who's been critical of the president quite a bit, I nonetheless recognize mm-hmm. that one of the secrets of his success is that he is generally a positive human being. He believes, you know, it comes off as cocky sometimes, but it's positivity, it's belief in what he can accomplish, and belief, more importantly, in what the nation can accomplish. And that's juxtaposed against vindictiveness and negativity and the sense that there's something wrong with us that's coming out of the left and that's being embodied in the candidates that are being put forward by the Democratic Party in this state. I mean, you got people like Keith Ellison seeking attorney general statewide. That really throws this state into play in an unprecedented way. And I really do believe there is that opportunity that, you know, Jason Lewis is not just speaking from a position of partisanship. There's a real chance that this state will go red.
Yeah, and being up there, you really felt that electricity at the time. As I drove around the city, you know, there were protesters there. That's to be expected with any president that comes into town. I don't think they were the numbers that I had been seeing in the media. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were the numbers that the Democrats were expecting up there.
Yeah.
But there was a presence, and that's to be fair. But to have 10,000 people in that arena for the rally and to turn
right.
away what I'm hearing is a couple thousand more,
right.
that says something for Duluth and northern Minnesota.
So. Oh, it's absolutely astounding. I mean, the idea, I've been to political rallies, you've been to political rallies. I've never been to a political rally with 10,000 people and people who couldn't get in. I've never heard of such a thing until
right.
Donald Trump came along.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I mean, to have a few thousand people show up is a great success.
Right.
To have what the president had in Duluth, I think, is beyond that. And I think it's you and I are political observers.
Yep.
It's something to really, really watch and study over the next
yeah.
few years. So
I remember a few years back when Sarah Palin came to town, you know, big national name. She was the party's vice presidential nominee. She came mm-hmm. to town and did a rally with Michelle Bachmann, and I think they had a couple other headliners, Tom Emmer and whatnot. And, you know, there were a lot of people there, but it was nowhere near. It wasn't even a fraction of what you guys just saw in Duluth, which
right.
is telling.
Exactly. Yeah, and to go back to the roundtable, to have the diverse number of people that were there from different industries, I mean, they're all kind of related with the steel industry, the taconite industry, mining, logging
right.
was
right.
also represented there as well. And from my understanding, they're not all Republicans up there, but
sure.
every one of them had thanked the president for what he was doing with the cutting of regulations, with lowering taxes, and they were all telling how it was helping them, both in their businesses and their families,
mm-hmm.
the surrounding communities,
mm-hmm.
the secondary types of industries that are benefiting from those industries doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was great to hear. And I know you probably talked to Jason Flores. There is an element to this that is a little troubling, which is the steel tariffs.
Correct.
That the president is imposing and also agricultural tariffs. And I'm hoping that the president and Congress reverses course so that those industries, the agriculture industry, which is really seeing the effects of it right now,
mm-hmm.
That it's reversed so that we're not going to lose the momentum that we're gaining with, which is today, the 6-month anniversary of the tax cut and jobs bill that was signed into law 6 months ago today that has seen impressive results.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go next is, you know, with the success that the Trump administration has had with this economy, you and I are on the same page in terms of attributing that to policies which recognize the power of the free market and the ability of individuals working either alone or in concert with others who they've chosen to do business with to pursue their chosen values and to do so seeking the highest value at the lowest price. That's the jet fuel for the economy that we're seeing in action now. And when you take actions such as these tariffs, which do exactly the opposite, it's going to end up canceling those benefits out, which would be deeply unfortunate because it'd be really nice to see this momentum continue.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And some of the other things that were talked about up there too with the industries, there was, you know, a lot of talk, there was quite a bit of talk about the tariffs and also a lot of talk about the cuts in regulation, which has spurred economic growth up there, and to see that continue. There was one gentleman, just a lighthearted moment, that was talking about there's, Pete Stauber is running for, Congress up in the 8th district.
Right.
And one gentleman brought up free trade, and I kind of perked up my ears. I was taking some notes. But what he actually said was, if Pete Stauber goes to Congress, I want fair trade and I want something in return for that. And that kind of got the crowd laughing. It was pretty interesting about that. But another gentleman had talked about Cleveland Cliffs up there and the investments that they are making and other companies up there that are making real investments and bringing jobs to the area. I mean, to the tune of like $75 million over the next couple of years and the hundreds of jobs that's going to bring. And that was really, really good to hear that as well. And the president had talked about some executive orders having to do with mineral mining and how he expects things to be done before the end of the year. And that's a great thing as well.
Kelly Gunderson from Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. Appreciate you joining us this evening and good job up there.
Hey, thanks, Walter. Thanks again for having me on. I hope to be on again with you soon.
All right. We'll see you very soon indeed. Take care. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Brad Omlin producing the show this evening. Catch us streaming, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us, as always. Appreciate you enduring the diatribe this evening. You know, I hope you understand what it is that I've been trying to get across during the course of tonight's program. In regards to our ongoing consideration of immigration policy, you know, the big takeaway being that when I talk about immigration, I'm not just talking about immigration. When I talk about immigration, I'm not just talking about the rules which should govern whether and how people cross our national border. I'm talking about the broader context of our culture and public policy that creates the problems that we perceive as being immigration problems, when they're really not immigration problems at all. They're liberty problems, or the lack thereof. All right, moving on to a couple of stories here in the news. The White House to propose merging labor and education into one agency. Now, as draining the swamp goes, I believe this certainly qualifies. From the Washington Post, the White House on Thursday will propose merging the education and labor departments into one federal agency, the centerpiece of a plan to remake a bureaucracy that President Trump and his supporters consider too big and bloated, according to an administration official familiar with the plan. The long-awaited proposal to reorganize federal agencies would shrink some and augment the missions of others. It is the result of a directive that Mick Mulvaney, head of the Office of Management and Budget, issued to federal leaders 14 months ago. He urged them to find ways to merge overlapping duplicative offices and programs and eliminate those the administration views as unnecessary. The plan also is expected to include major changes to the ways that government provides benefits for low-income Americans, an area that conservatives have long targeted as excessive, by consolidating safety net programs that are administered through multiple agencies. This is great news. This is fantastic. And we'll see what the details of the proposal ultimately are. But look, you guys are used to hearing me being critical of the Trump administration. You're used to hearing me being critical of Donald Trump, the man, you know, of the way that he conducts himself rhetorically and what have you. But listen, I am enthusiastic to praise him when he does something right. And this is right. You know, it not only is it right in terms of the effect of what it is that he's going to accomplish here, but it's right in terms of the presentation of how it's being sold. He's not selling it as, I'm eliminating agencies, I'm eliminating programs. He's selling it as merging and reorganization and efficiency. And listen, I don't care how you sell it as long as the effect of it is the same. Government shrinks. The bureaucracy shrinks. The administrative state lessens in size. That's what I want to see, and it's fantastic to see that coming out of the Trump administration. And hey, make America great again. 100% if that's the way we're going to do it. All right. From the Daily Wire, famed atheist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, felt triggered by comments from Pope Francis over the weekend likening eugenics abortion to Nazi crimes. In the last century, the entire world was scandalized by what the Nazis did to ensure the purity of the race, the Richard said. Today, we do the same, but with white gloves. And what the, by the way, it's not mentioned here, but what the Pope was addressing was the elective use of abortion specifically to weed out defects such as Down syndrome, right? So, I mean, that is eugenics. Like, that's not an exaggeration. That's not hyperbole. If you say, I want to know whether or not my kid has Down syndrome so that I can kill them if they do, you are a eugenicist, which puts you in the same category as a Nazi. I hate to break it to you, but that's what the Nazis were all about. The purification of the race, getting rid of those who are deemed lesser than on account of their characteristics that are arbitrary and capricious. Continuing at the Daily Wire, the evolutionary biologist, again, Richard Dawkins, disagreed with the Pope, saying such abortions are about avoiding human suffering. And you thought that Francis was the good Pope, mocked Dawkins on Twitter. Abortion to avoid birth defects is not about eugenics. It's about the avoidance of individual human suffering. Ah, yes. Right. Yeah, because rhetoric like that wasn't employed by the Nazis either. As noted by Life News, the human suffering that Dawkins refers to here is disingenuous, considering that many parents of Down children report loving their children and having much joy in their family. Imagine that. Dawkins advised such families to just abort it and try again in 2014 when one Twitter follower asked what to do about her Down syndrome diagnosed baby. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice, Dawkins had said. Ugh. It just absolutely, completely, utterly reprehensible. Yeah, this way of looking at things. And again, you know, I hate to tie it back into the immigration argument, but it's the same basic idea, right? That because there's a chance that things might go bad for you, we're just going to get rid of you or say you can't come here or whatever the case may be. This is not the proper way to address life, which is so important and so abundant and so meaningful in terms of its potential, no matter who it is that we're considering as the bearer of that gift from God. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
for listening to KTLK AM Minneapolis. Don't miss Justice and Drew every weekday morning, 6 to 9 on AM 1130, 103.5 FM, and the iHeartRadio app.